Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. We were scheduled to be speaking today with a faculty colleague of mine, Dr. Yuri Maltsev, professor of economics at Carthage College. I believe I have made a mistake with the calendar. I don't believe the mistake is Professor Maltsev's, but he has not appeared, and we will be sure to reschedule him at his earliest possible convenience. We're anxious to have him on the morning show. In its place, however, we will be having a replay of one of my favorite interviews from the last couple of years, which looks back at a very memorable season of Major League Baseball. Stay with us for a look at the summer of 68. Around the 1st of April, of course, among other things, it is time for another season of Major League Baseball to begin. And it's great timing to be talking about a fascinating book called Summer of 68, The Season That Changed Baseball and America Forever. 1968, of course, is a year indelibly burned in the memory of anyone who was alive then, and even for those who are too young to have actually lived through 1968, surely most Americans are very well acquainted with the great turbulence that rocked our nation in 1968 and the years preceding it and following it. It was tough times for America in many respects. And even in the means by which we tried to escape from the worst that reality had to throw at us, one could not fully escape that tumult, even in the world of sports. That's kind of the contention of this book called Summer of 68, written by a highly acclaimed writer and sports writer, Tim Wendell. He has examined that year of 1968 and some of the ways in which our major sports were affected by the events that were swirling around our country and some of the controversies that were dividing our nation so deeply. And among the most important stories which played out that year was the story of the Detroit Tigers and their inspiring march to baseball's championship. That is a victory in the World Series, a very hard-fought, come-from-behind victory over the St. Louis Cardinals. And that was a very special drama in and of itself. We're going to talk with Tim Wendell about this book. His previous work includes High Heat, The Secret History of the Fastball, and The Improbable Search for the Fastest Pitcher of All Time, and a book which I've read and enjoyed very much called Going for the Gold, How the U.S. Olympic Hockey Team Won at Lake Placid. Again, this book is called Summer of 68, now in paperback from Da Capo Press. Tim Wendell, we welcome you to the morning show.
Great to be with you, Greg.
I wonder if you could just say a word about, if anything in particular, about 1968 prompted you to put this book together and to weave all these different stories together. Was there one particular sports moment in 1968 that sort of set all this in motion?
Well, I think the sports moment I think that comes up, Greg, is and you mentioned it in the introduction, is Detroit and the Tigers. I don't think any team's been under more pressure starting off a season than the Detroit Tigers were in 1968, in large part because Detroit, as many of your listeners will remember, unfortunately had seen the worst riot since the Civil War the season before, the summer before. Large swaths of the city had burned, and police officials, city officials, had pretty much come to the team and said, you know, it'd be really great if you guys won this year, because it would not only be, you know, fun to win a pennant, which they had fallen one game short of in 67 when the Red Sox won in the American League, but it could save the city. And you talk about a lot of pressure, and this team kind of rose to the occasion. And I think in just kind of starting off at that point and talking with some of the individuals in Detroit, I was reminded again what a unifying force sports can be. I think sometimes we kind of put it off to one side, and it's entertainment, and it's this and that, and certainly it's all those things. But in 1968 in Detroit, the police soon learned that things had changed for the better, in large part because of baseball. And the season before, in 67, if you saw some individuals on a street corner in downtown Detroit, that usually meant trouble. And they quickly learned in 68 that, no, people are now gathering around, probably somebody holding a transistor radio. They're listening to the, you know, melodic tone of Ernie Harwell, the famous Tigers announcer, call the play-by-play. And ironically, in that season, too, the Tigers made a real habit of coming from behind late in ball games. And so simply them, you know, reaching a new level, it held the city together. And I think time and time again, I couldn't believe in 68 that sports had a real impact. And I kind of have come to the belief something held us together in 1968. And as you alluded in the introduction, 68 was a terrible time. Mm. Assassinations of Dr. King, Bobby Kennedy, riots. As my friend Hampton Side says, it's probably the closest we've come to a second civil war in this country. But something held us together. And I think time and time again, it was sports and people being able to go to the ballpark or even the arenas and seeing black, whites, even Latinos somehow together in a common purpose while their own communities perhaps are being torn apart.
You just touched on the matter of city officials in Detroit going to the Tigers and saying, please, please win. So obviously on some very real level, they had an awareness of what you were just saying, namely that sports was a unifying factor at a time when so much was splitting our country apart. Do you think that perception was actually all that widespread? I mean, do you think the typical American thought very much about what you were just saying, or is that something that we see much more clearly in retrospect?
I think we see it maybe, Greg, more clearly in retrospect, but something that I think was different in 68 along these lines, which was very powerful and important, was I think the athletes took more responsibility as being members of a community. Now, one could argue maybe it was easier for them to do. I mean, they weren't making as much money back then as they are now. In a sense, they didn't live off in some gated community and such. And I think what we saw in 68, not just in Detroit but elsewhere, but, you know, two instances in Detroit that really kind of drove home to me how much the athletes were still among us, for lack of a better term. Willie Horton, the outfielder for Detroit Tigers, who grew up in the projects of Detroit, went down as the riots were starting in 67 and single-handedly tried to stop him. He was still wearing his Detroit Tigers uniform, and unfortunately he wasn't successful, but people still remember that in Detroit. They remember, hey, a ball player came down and urged us, in a sense, to do the right thing. Another guy who was a member of the Tigers, and you kind of forget how much of an impact things had upon ball players and such. Many were in the National Guard, and one of them was Mickey Lolich, who pitched the first game of a doubleheader on that unfortunate Saturday in 67 where Detroit started the burn, and by the end of the second game had pretty much received his orders, you need to switch out of that ball player uniform and you need to put on your National Guard, in a sense, uniform or fatigues. Your unit has been assigned to patrol downtown Detroit. And so I think that's something, one reason why certainly members of the Tigers and certainly members of the Cardinals, that other great team that was in the 68 World Series, are remembered so fondly today, because I think they're remembered as being like us, among us, and they tried to do the right thing.
In other words, the great sports celebrities of the day were not nearly so insulated from the general public as they are today.
Exactly. And I don't think they thought of themselves as entertainers. You know, I think they thought of themselves as guys that played baseball and lived down the block from you and me. And I think in that way, when they said or did something, you know, Willie Horton going down and standing on top of a taxi cab in Detroit and begging people to go home and not burn this city that he loved, it had a much more, it resonated in a much stronger way than maybe somebody popping on TV today and saying, just say no.
At one point you say this, most of the time sports exists in a different orbit from the real news of the day. Even sports writers like to kid that they work in the toy department, fortunate to be caught up in less serious matters. But in 68, time after time, those lines became blurred. I wonder if you could just say a word more about the way in which those lines just did not seem to exist in 1968 the way that they typically did.
Well, I think athletes, even today, you know, and I still cover a lot of them, in a basic way, they are like you and me. They would, you know, they aren't, they don't really like to maybe talk politics that much and serious issues. Okay, I'd rather put them at arm's length and just deal with what I need to deal with. And something you'll hear from a lot of athletes is, I'm tuning it all out. You know, I'm in my own little world, and that helps me kind of move ahead with hitting, pitching, whatever it may be. What I was struck by in the summer of 68, Greg, was that time and time again, athletes, just like the average Americans, were rocked out of their world. And I was stunned and even heartened by how a lot of them responded. Case in point is Bob Gibson, the staff ace for the St. Louis Cardinals. Bob is remembered as having one of the best seasons a pitcher ever had in 1968. Yet he didn't get off to all that great a start. He was overshadowed by Don Drysdale's scoreless inning streak in the National League. Over in the American League, we had a perfect game from Catfish Hunter, etc. It wasn't like he started the season right out front as the pitcher, as he was remembered to be by the end. And looking back on it, I think he was really shook by Dr. King's assassination in Memphis. That delayed the start of the baseball season by a couple days. It really underscored how tumultuous the year was going to be for America. And yet, Bob Gibson really responded just a couple months later, unfortunately, when Bobby Kennedy is assassinated at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles. It's in his first start after Kennedy's assassination that Bob Gibson pitches his first shutout of the season. Gibson goes on to throw 13 shutouts, an earned run average of 1.12. I mean, any baseball fan will tell you those are numbers, you know, you're not going to see maybe ever again. And I think the quote that I loved from Gibson was, in essence, yeah, I was saddened, shook, whatever, when they killed Dr. King. But when they killed Bobby Kennedy, I became infuriated. And somehow he was able to channel this passion, anger, even disgust with what was going on around him into one of the most epic pitching performances of all time. And so time and time again, we had people that, you know, we view now as athletes and celebrities that are somehow above us or beyond us, but they were responding in some very human ways that I think can be lessons for us even today.
Hmm. You have a couple of interesting quotes about Bob Gibson talking exactly about this. One, simply that I pitched better angry. That is, he seemed to have a way of channeling his anger or frustration or indignation about something into unbelievably fine pitching. But another quote that we find here that I think is quite intriguing is when you say, Gibson decided that the only thing he could do was to out-pitch his situation.
Mm-hmm.
That pitching well was a way to, in a sense, rise above the frustration and tumult of the moment.
And I think in looking back on his life, he'd been doing that for a long time before 68. I mean, 68 was certainly when things reached the highest pinnacle, perhaps, for him, the zenith. But, you know, you're talking about a guy who, you know, grew up pretty much without a father. You know, his big brother was the father figure to him, and they pretty much played baseball, and he was a tremendous athlete, and yet time and time again was reminded of his race, I guess, for lack of a better term. I mean, he was a tremendous basketball player. I mean, in a lot of ways, basketball may have been his best sport. He played for a couple years with the Harlem Globetrotters. That's how good he was, but he didn't like the clowning. And at one point, coming out of high school, Gibson even indicated to Indiana University, you know, which is a great basketball school, that, you know, he'd be interested in coming there. And pretty much the response he got at that point from Indiana, and thankfully this has changed, you know, much more over the years, obviously, is no, in a sense, we have our quota of black athletes. We're kind of filled up on that end. And I think time and time again in Gibson's life, he hit walls in this venue, and yet would find a way to pretty much go through them. Yeah. And I think that's why, in a lot of ways, he looked so angry out on the mound, because he had learned from a very young age to channel that into performance.
We're speaking with Tim Wendel about his book, Summer of 68, The Season That Changed Baseball and America Forever. It's a story not only of the Detroit Tigers and their desperate bid to at last win the World Series, but it's a very pivotal year in a couple of different ways. One of them, and I think we've danced around this already but not maybe said it in so many words yet, is that 1968 was called the Year of the Pitcher. It was a year in which Bob Gibson was just one of a plethora of superbly gifted, effective pitchers. And they were so good that ultimately it led to kind of a remaking of the rules of baseball in order to sort of tip the scales back towards hitting. Say a word about this constellation of exceptional pitchers and how it was that there was so much greatness at one time. I mean, had baseball never seen this before?
I don't think they'd ever really seen it, Greg, in terms of veteran pitchers almost kind of going one more time around the block with a flourish. I mean, Drysdale, Gibson, you know, we haven't really touched on Denny McClain, who wins, you know, 31 for the Tigers. And yet we had a great rise of new young pitchers coming up. I mean, we had guys like Louis Tiant has an earned run average of 1.60 in the American League for Cleveland at that point. Catfish Hunter, who I mentioned before, a perfect game. I remember talking with Nolan Ryan about this at one point, who was just starting to reach the major leagues at this point, and he said, you had to be really good. You know, and you not only had to be, you know, physically good with the pitches, but you had to be mentally tough, because every night you were going to go out against, you know, pretty much, you know, a Gibson or a Drysdale or a Ferguson Jenkins and things like that. And I think it was just one of those times where the stars were in alignment and we had this great era of pitching that I think demanded so much of pitchers when they would go out each night. Also, I feel they had a real sense of responsibility. I think, you know, talk to Ryan or guys from that era, they say one of the worst things we've done is pitch counts and, you know, six innings is a quality start, because nobody, as he says, wants to finish what they started. But often it kind of goes back again to the backdrop and people being put in difficult situations and rising to the occasion, usually with some very human choices or feelings about it. I mean, we just talked a little bit about Gibson channeling his anger or channeling his passion of what was going on around him. Then you have almost a completely different case in point with Denny McClain over with Detroit. Denny McClain, you know, is the first guy in decades to win more than 30 games. And yet he did it in a way, you know, we talk about celebrity, he kind of embraced being a celebrity. He embraced, in essence, somehow the fun of that era and rose above it. Somebody asked him early on, or about mid-season, Denny, what's your real goal for this year? Is it the Tigers finally win the pennant? You came so close in 67. Is it to win 30 games, be the first guy in decades to do that? And Denny kind of said, well, those are all good, and, you know, I hope we do them, but I'd really like to be on the Ed Sullivan Show. So, you know, in a way he was using, you know, he was a very good musician, played the organ, and that kind of proved to be his outlet. And one of the stats I love, there's so many great stats out of the 68-year. And I'm not a big stats guy, but there's amazing ones. I mean, Gibson's 1.12 ERA, Teon's 1.60 in the American League. But you have two very, very different individuals in Gibson and McClain. And you can almost see them like looking at each other at times going, what's that guy doing? Both of them are the MVP in their respective leagues. Both of them win the Cy Youngs. Both of them are using very different ways to kind of grapple with the pressure and what's going on in the country in 68. Yet both of them also pitch 28 complete games each. And again, that's a stat I don't think we're going to see again. We make a big deal when guys pitch 10 or 11 complete games in a season. Yet both of those guys, coming at it in very different ways, both reached the top of the mountain, so to speak.
The other big story involving baseball at this moment in time, 1968, is that in this year, Major League Baseball is still the pinnacle of American sports. It dominates the landscape more than any other sport, but that is not going to continue much longer. It is about to lose that, or it is about to lose ground to professional football. Can you say a word about sort of the forces that were at play that were going to lead to this shift?
Sure. I think, and they never saw it coming. I mean, it's so funny these days, Greg, we live in this world where, you know, the TV ratings are so precise and you can see these little blips up and down. Football didn't really know it was really coming into its own, that it had a chance to be the number one sport until the Heidi game. And the Heidi game is a game where it was a game between the Jets and the Raiders on NBC. At the top of the hour at 7 o'clock East Coast time, they contractually had to cut away and show a made-for-TV movie called Heidi, which starred Julie Andrews' stepdaughter. And the uproar about this stunned everybody, especially the football powers that be. And they didn't realize, in essence, how popular their game had become. And even today, I mean, so much of what sports and even our lives are today, you can trace back to this period. Even today, you know, if the football game is going long, 60 Minutes isn't coming on at the top of the hour. It's going to wait until after the football game's done. You can trace that right back to the Heidi game. And I think baseball was so, I don't know, fat and sassy or didn't see this coming, that they just didn't do some of the things that maybe would have helped them out with popularity of the fans. The other thing that's coming on strong, as you well know, Greg, besides football, is the Olympics. 68 is pretty much the first time we decide to have live programming and such. And there's a situation toward the end of 68 where they start getting the first test, and they aren't even quite sure what's going on. But this is about performance-enhancing drugs and steroids and how performance can be elevated potentially by chemicals. And both the International Olympic Committee and Major League Baseball were kind of given these tests. And nobody was quite sure at that point what was going on. But I've always been struck by the reactions of both those entities. Major League Baseball's reaction was, I don't know, who knows what's going on, we'll table this. International Olympic Committee's response was, we're not sure what's going on here, but if it hurts the level of competition or destroys that, we're going to ban it. And those were two very different reactions, and we kind of saw what happened in the decades after that.
We're speaking with Tim Wendel, the author of Summer of 68. Mr. Wendel, do you have time for a couple more questions?
Oh, yeah, for sure, Greg.
If we could just circle back to the Heidi game for a moment. I had certainly heard about this and knew a little bit about it, but you write so interestingly about exactly what happened and kind of the unfortunate circumstances under which this occurred and the sort of series of forgivable human errors. I think that's the way some network executive put it. I was really intrigued that you tell us that I think it's the NFL film archives not only have the footage of that game that was interrupted before its dramatic conclusion, but you can also go to NFL Films and watch Heidi. That is the thing that came on. And one of the most interesting things you described to us is something that was, in a sense, still more unfortunate, which occurred at one of the most dramatic moments in this Heidi telecast. So this is well after the football game itself is done, and of course the switchboard at NBC is already broken down from the strain of all these angry calls. Can you describe to our listeners what happens at one point during a very dramatic, moving moment during this television movie, then, that in some ways just adds insult to injury?
Yeah, you talk about a train wreck, Greg. This is a mess.
Really?
First of all, they cut away from the game, which the Jets are winning and then end up losing because the Raiders score two touchdowns in the last roughly 2 minutes. And so you have much of the country. Now, people have to make a leap of faith here a little bit. This is before, obviously, you could call up any highlight you wanted on your computer. It's before the cell phone, et cetera. So most of the country thought the Jets won. No, they lost. In fact, prompting the great line from Joe Namath, who was the quarterback for the Jets, something effective, I heard we lost, but I'll have to check the replay. And so the switchboard at NBC is melting down. And the powers that be in the network are going, oh, we've totally messed this up. And at first they try to go back out, the game's in Oakland, out to Oakland and get Kurt Gowdy or somebody to kind of do a stand-up. But those guys have already left. They've been told we're not on the air anymore, so they went home. And so at this very pivotal point of Heidi, and I think NFL Films knew about this because when I went up to watch the tape, they had left the Heidi film out there along with the football stuff and other stuff that I had requested. And so I'm watching the Heidi film, and at the pivotal point that you talk about, there's a young girl in a wheelchair, and she suddenly, I don't know, decides to walk or something. And you've got this backdrop of the Swiss Alps and this soaring music, and this young woman gets up out of her wheelchair and falls forward, and she seems determined to get up and walk, and the wheelchair is rolling away. Anyway, at that point, the powers that be at NBC decided, we have to let people know the Raiders won the game, not the Jets. And they put, you know, what they call in the business a trailer across the bottom. Unfortunately, trailers aren't like we have today, which take up, I don't know, maybe about an eighth of the screen or something like that, and we have bigger TVs. This one took up about a third of the screen. So there you have this poor woman trying to stand and walk on her own, and across the bottom you have the trailer running, our apologies, the Raiders beat the Jets, blah, blah, blah. It's just a mess, and it almost looks like she's having a reaction to
the
Jets losing.
It underscores kind of the relatively primitive nature of network television back then, and of very fallible humans scrambling around making, and it would seem, one poor choice after another, and not sort of realizing the consequences of it. But you also point out that this was a time when television ratings were not quite as specific as they are now, and so that there really wasn't as clear a sense of just how popular some of these NFL football telecasts were until this Heidi game. I mean, there would not have been such an uproar if there hadn't been so many people watching and caring so deeply about what they were watching. I mean, this Heidi game was a way to finally ascertain that.
Very much so. And I think, you know, like, things just weren't as precise. They weren't able to measure ratings and such that well. And as you say, Greg, things were kind of primitive and they were kind of feeling their way. And, you know, the other thing that we just kind of take as matter of fact now, I mean, it's kind of a debate, you know, with the Olympics. Okay, how much is it going to be tape delay? We want it live, et cetera. And back in 68, Rune Arledge took over, you know, in a sense, the Olympics for ABC. And one of the first things he asks is, why aren't we showing more of this live? And everybody just kind of looks at each other going, because it was all tape delay pretty much till that point. And, you know, like Jean-Claude Keeley in the Winter Olympics and Peggy Fleming, it was all taped. And he suddenly said, no, we ought to do this more of this live. And the executives in the room just looking at each other like, duh, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Why are we doing more of this live? And that prompts the Olympics now to become – such a huge programming force that it is today. At that point in time, in the summer of 68 or in the fall of 68, everybody was afraid of baseball. They did not start the Olympics until after the World Series ended. And you think about that today and you just go, wow, that's flipped, because the Olympics are so huge and powerful.
Wow. One of the things you do that I think is very impressive, and I don't think I mentioned that you're a writer in residence at Johns Hopkins University, and obviously a very fine writer. Only a fine writer would be able to write such a clear, coherent book which weaves together so many different storylines. That is, this is not just a book about baseball in 1968 or football beginning to usurp baseball in 1968, but you tell a number of other crucial sports stories as well, including involving the U.S. Olympics, and in particular the plight of U.S. runners facing the challenge of high-altitude running in these Mexico City Olympic Games. Just had a word about that. Could you just say a word about weaving together all of these different storylines? At any point, did you ever regret your choice of writing a book with this sort of complexity?
Yeah, there were some days I was going, what am I doing? But thank you, Greg. You're being very kind. I guess the rule of thumb became finding characters or situations, which there were many, which were about ready to change or flip or become more of what we're accustomed to. And in the case of the Olympics, you had Jim Ryan, who was the best middle distance guy in the world, coming to race in Mexico City at altitude, and nobody really understood what he was up against. I mean, and that seems almost incredible today that we have so much training for altitude. Many runners train at altitude, come back down and compete at lower elevation, etc. This was all, nobody really had wrapped their mind around this. And poor Jim Ryan became kind of the guinea pig for kind of being ill-prepared for such things. And ironically, as I was kind of doing that research and talking with Jim and some of the coaches that were trying to wrap their mind around the best way to prepare to run at altitude, I remember one day I was looking at the results from the Olympics, and suddenly I go, oh, this is the first Olympics that the Kenyans win at. And win in running. And today, the Kenyans win everything. And I found this great line where the Kenyans, with Kip Kenyo, who beats Jim Ryan in the 1500, etc., they show up to compete in Mexico City, and they pretty much have gone out for their first run or something, training run or something after being in the city. And one of them says, wow, feels like home.
Right.
Yeah, things are about ready to change, aren't they?
Right.
And now the Kenyans are going to take over the running world. And so that kind of became hopefully the thing that kept it in line, where situations were on the brink of changing forever.
Absolutely. And, of course, I think you do a really persuasive job of helping us appreciate Jim Ryan's accomplishment in even finishing second. I mean, of finishing at all under those circumstances. And you tell us that there was somebody working for the U.S. Olympic team who was some kind of specialist in high altitude. I don't remember his name now, but it turns out he was given essentially no funding and nobody really listened to his advice. I mean, in a sense, the Olympic organization, U.S. Olympic organization, sort of tipped their hat to the issue, but really didn't take it seriously, and paid dearly for that.
Yeah, very much so. And this is Coach Daniels that you learned to, who was one of the first guys to start figuring out at altitude, well, you just can't have somebody go up and run around a little bit on a mountain every now and then. It would be good to have them, compete at altitude, get to oxygen debt and such. And ironically, as you say, Greg, nobody listened to him in 68, yet Daniels goes on to become a longtime famous running coach at Cortland State in New York, and Runner's World cites him as one of the top coaches of the, of the 80s and into the 90s. And so, again, a guy kind of ahead of his time, but unfortunately in the case of Jim Ryan, you know, who he really tried to help, not enough people were backing him up.
We finally need to talk about, of course, a couple of the most serious, dramatic moments of 1968 and the way in which they intersected with these athletes and the sports that they were playing. I'm thinking, of course, of the two assassinations, Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy, and, of course, the dramatic events of the Democratic Convention in Chicago. And you outlined for us in amazing detail the ramifications, both on the surface and sort of behind the scenes, the way in which the sports world was rocked by all three of these events. We'll leave our listeners to sort of sort out and seek out the details in your book, but say what you will about this real-life drama and tragedy as it played out in the lives of some of these important athletes.
Well, I think time and time again, Greg, I was struck by the lack of leadership from on high and how people, ball players, regular citizens, were kind of left to their own devices to a certain degree. Gates Brown, the great pinch hitter in Detroit, was one of the first interviews I did, and early on he said, you have to remember what this was like. In a sense, at some point that season, that year, broke your heart, and you weren't going to be quite sure how it was going to be or what was going to happen, but it would. And I think, you know, looking back on it, the lack of leadership, one instance that I'm just astounded by is the commissioner's office, baseball commissioner's office, after Bobby Kennedy's assassination in June, early June, they pretty much didn't do much. They told teams in New York and Washington, okay, we're not going to play tonight in memory or whatever of Kennedy's assassination. But then they turned around and told all the other teams, well, you guys decide. Take a team vote. And you talk about, you know, putting a divisive issue suddenly in the middle of almost every baseball clubhouse. We're going to vote whether we're going to play or not after Kennedy's been assassinated. And it tore apart some teams. I mean, you had the Cincinnati Reds, which were in shambles over it. They had several votes, people changing their votes, people abstaining. Finally, with their player representative, Milt Pappas, who is pleading with his team not to play when ownership is pretty much, you know, pushing them to do so, getting traded, you know, for his trouble. And you had the Pittsburgh Pirates, where Roberto Clemente didn't want to play and was really pressed to play the following day. And Maury Wills, at that point on that team, who pretty much told management, I'm retiring to the trainer's room. In fact, I'm going to read a book written by Bobby Kennedy. You know, find me whatever amount you want. I don't care. I'm not playing. And then you had other teams that ironically used it, this tumultuous event that rocked the country, as a way to kind of bring themselves together. I think one of the most amazing examples of leadership that I found, and it didn't have anything to do with the commissioner's office, was the New York Mets were playing in San Francisco, or supposed to play, the game at the day after Kennedy's assassination. Their manager, Gil Hodges, went to every player in the hotel and said, do not go to the ballpark today. We are not going to play. And if we get, you know, whatever trouble, whatever, you know, responsibility, I will bear it. I'll bear the load. But do not show up at the ballpark. And the Giants were incensed by this. It was bat day at the old Candlestick. It looked like they were going to have a huge walk-up gate. They're going to make some money. And yet their opposing team doesn't show up. And you talk to some of those Mets now, and, of course, the Mets went on to become the amazing Mets in 69 and win the World Series, et cetera. A lot of them point back at that tough time where baseball teams were getting pulled apart, and they stuck together, in large part because their manager had their back, so to speak.
Mm. As you describe this chaos in the wake of the Kennedy assassination, one point you make that I had never seen mentioned before is the very prominent role that a number of important athletes played in Robert Kennedy's presidential campaign. You tell us that some 50 star athletes and or coaches had enlisted to help Bobby Kennedy in his presidential bid. And I suppose that says something, too, about that point in time, especially in terms of the prominence of athletes in this sort of venture. I mean, I don't think now we think of professional athletes getting involved to that extent. I mean, I think it would be kind of a shock if one of our major presidential candidates could parade a list of 50 athletes who had come out publicly in support of him or her. That seems quite unlikely in this day and age.
Yeah, and I think it's a loss, too, Greg. I think, and some of those athletes are amazing. Bill Russell, you know, Oscar Robertson recorded radio spots for Bobby Kennedy. And it's interesting how intertwined this was, and I think maybe at times it was for the better. I mean, one of the stories I love, you know, the Kennedys were sportsmen. I mean, they knew their sports, and I think it goes beyond playing, you know, tag football on Hickory Hill or something like that. And so, to the point that, like, when Vince Lombardi steps down as the legendary coach of the Packers, which happens on the eve of the 68th season, one of the first guys he receives a telegram from is Bobby Kennedy. And it was a little tongue-in-cheek, but I don't think that much. And it said something effective, you know, hey, coach, you're stepping down from your team. How about joining mine? And there was some serious consideration of Vince Lombardi, the legendary Packers coach, being a running mate with Bobby Kennedy. And that even continued after Kennedy's death at the Democratic National Convention, which, of course, blows up into all kinds of insanity in Chicago in late August. There was, in the early days of that convention, some support of maybe putting Lombardi on the ticket with, whoever, would, you know, I guess at that point, Humphrey. Richard Nixon was interested in Vince Lombardi being his running mate, believe it or not, until somebody did some homework on the Republican side and figured out that in the Lombardi household, it wasn't Vince who was the Democrat, it was his wife Marie, and so they were kind of targeting the wrong person. And that's, again, 68's a swirl, and things that we tend to divide up and have in these nice little neat packages today, it wasn't like that. And I think, again, that's maybe one reason why we were able to persevere, is athletes didn't feel that maybe they were just athletes. They were also felt that they were citizens, and maybe it would be a good time to speak up and do what's right at some points, too.
Hmm. Your book ultimately is, in so many respects, the story of the city of Detroit. And one of the chapters opens with these words: "The only way to truly understand Detroit then and now is to drive its streets." Can we just take 1 minute and have you describe to our listeners your visit to Detroit? It's a very moving experience for you, I think.
Very much. I mean, I have I have family from Michigan, not Detroit, but I can remember going to Detroit as a kid. And I was really fortunate that a good friend of mine, Tom Stanton, who's a great writer, and based in the Detroit area, he's the one that took me on kind of the tour of Detroit. And I was stunned, Greg, because part of it's memory. Part of it is maybe just kind of being in certain parts of the town over the years and not seeing others, you know, like where the old ballpark was, where the new ballpark, you know, now is. I wasn't ready for this, and where you could be driving in a city that until, you know, within our lifetime was the eighth, ninth largest city in the country, and be driving down some street, and then it's like the city disappears. It's gone. I mean, there's no buildings, there's no street lights, there's nothing. There's just these huge swaths of nothing, or, you know, open space, to the point that among the things they're looking at are bringing in cattle to graze on these fields or maybe grow crops, and you just go, wow, what has happened here? Because I think a large part of what people think of now as Detroit is, I don't know, crime or trouble or whatever, but Detroit built this country, you know, the cars we drive, the way, you know, America was so much of industrial might. You know, I don't think we win World War II without, you know, Detroit being able to kind of retool itself and churn out tanks and, you know, things like that as opposed to cars. So much of America that we are right now is because of Detroit. And then to go there and see how desperate things have become is very, very eerie.
The book once again is called Summer of 68, The Season That Changed Baseball in America Forever. This is now a paperback from Da Capo Press, and its author, Tim Wendell. Tim Wendell, I congratulate you on a really, really fascinating and interesting book. And I thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show. Very best wishes to you.
My pleasure, Greg. Thank you.
Well, I'm happy to say that Professor Yuri Maltsev, who was scheduled to join us today on The Morning Show, was able to get here. He was delayed in getting to the station, and so we are recording an interview that is going to air on tomorrow's program. So I hope that you will make a point of listening for our conversation. Later this week, we will be hearing, among other things, from another faculty colleague, Jerry Mast, from the Political Science Department, and you'll hear my conversation with Simon Sebag Montefiore. He is the author of a truly fascinating book called The Romanovs, 1613 to 1918. In this really interesting book, Mr. Montefiore examines the long, fascinating, and often troubling history of the Romanov family. It is a span of 304 years and 20 different sovereigns who led Russia. And there are, of course, fascinating figures like Peter the Great and Catherine the Great. And, of course, there is the story of the last of the czars, Nicholas II, and many other fascinating figures who are not nearly so well known, who figure prominently in Mr. Montefiore's book. So we look forward to sharing that interview with you as well. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, wgtd.org. Click on Talk. Support for The Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for The Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com.